Well, who were the American showmen? What exactly did they show? And when and where did they show it? The aim of every one of them was to provide entertainment, some homely and simple, some of it sophisticated.
Everything's coming up roses. Clear the deck. Clear the track.
Ultra sophisticated.
In all the day's eclipse, the stocking was licked on the something shocking. I have a note. Anything goes.
Some romantic.
I don't know what day it is, or if it's dark or fair. Somehow that's just the way it is, and I don't really care.
That was their idea of a heroine, and this their idea of a hero.
I love your funny face, your funny, funny face.
To the showman, whose idea of entertainment went no further than the box office, it all sounded a bit like this. But above all, why did they bother? I mean, what exactly were they up to? The name of the game they were playing was entertainment, and it was a game that they played with consistent shrewdness. Take Ziegfeld, for instance. Ziegfeld, the one name that symbolizes for the man in the street the idea of a great showman, and yet the most difficult and elusive of all our subjects in this series, if only because at some time in the last 50 years, his name has become a point of reference for every producer and impresario who ever pulled the rug from under his backers. He's a regular Ziegfeld, people say to this day, much as you might say of a general that he was a bit of a Bonaparte, or of a writer that he was typical Charles Dickens. Illusions and wrong facts and false impressions have stuck to the Ziegfeld reputation like barnacles to an old hulk. So half the point of telling Ziegfeld's story is to untell all the bits that never happened or that have been magnified beyond recognition or are just plain fabrication by well-wishers and knockers alike. So, to start at the beginning, let's nail the first misconception. Lorenz Ziegfeld wasn't a girl, but a bouncing boy who began bouncing in Chicago on March 15, 1867. Next misconception, he wasn't Jewish, although, as someone once remarked of him, if Ziegfeld isn't Jewish, at least he's famous enough to be. In fact, he came of German Lutheran stock. So, when Keenan Wynn straightens out the religious background, he moves forward two paces and steps back three by getting the country wrong.
See, many people thought, because of his name, he was Jewish, which he was not. See, the Schuberts were Jewish, but Mr. Ziegfeld was a Swiss. His father had been a famous musician, a teacher, a music teacher.
Exactly how famous the father was remains in doubt, because Ziegfeld Sr. was one of those men who had a harmless habit of making up the past as he went along. But whatever his qualifications, his son Florenz had no time for classical music at all, and from his teens began to hang around the music halls. Probably the sort of thing that was his line in music sounded something like this.
There is a tavern in the town, and there my true love sits him down and drinks his wine as merry as can be, and never, never thinks of me. Fare thee well, for I must leave thee, do not let this parting grieve thee, and remember that the best of friends must part, adieu, kind friends, adieu, yes, adieu, I can no longer stay with you, I'll hang my heart on a weeping willow tree, and may the world go well with thee, I'll hang my heart on a weeping willow tree, and may the world go well with thee.
In a sense, that sound tells us more about Flo Ziegfeld's upbringing and early showbiz environment than all the histories and biographies in the world. The music sounds innocent because in the 1890s, showbiz itself was innocent. Not in the business sense, however, because there were more sharks on Broadway than along the entire Pacific seaboard. There were no copyright laws involving payment to Europe, which meant that any American showman could burgle to his heart's content. Around the time Flo Ziegfeld was first listening to popular music, New York was positively saturated with this example of typical homegrown American art. Messrs. Gilbert and Sullivan could fulminate all they liked about the iniquities of American musical pirates, but they were powerless to do anything about it. As for Ziegfeld, his tastes were rather less true blue. Instead, like all first-generation immigrants, he was fanatically patriotic. Now, there couldn't be anything more American than his first brush with entertainment, which happened in 1883. When he was 16 years old, young Flo conceived a passion for the traveling show of that old charlatan, Buffalo Bill Cody. And when Buffalo Bill arrived in Chicago offering money to any member of the audience who could outshoot Annie Oakley, it was Flo who won the money. It was not the last time he would upstage another producer. The question which arises out of the Buffalo Bill interlude is, did Ziegfeld really know what he was doing? I mean, here was the future doyen of American showmen, the arbiter of good taste on stage, getting besotted with a bunch of cigar store Indians who glorified the American horse. Did he know where he was going, or was he just plain lucky? One of the musicians who worked for him was Larry Adler.
This was a humorless man. He could recognize talent. He had a great eye for talent. And he knew when a man was a good comedian, but he never got the jokes. I never saw Ziegfeld laugh. He would sit there with a sort of impassive poker face. He always wore a rather high color. And he was very partial to his own showgirls. He married one of them, Anna Held, who became very famous. She used to take milk baths. She was the first one to make that popular. But I never, never, never heard him laugh at a joke or make one himself.
Now, a man who can keep a straight face when his girlfriend is taking milk baths must be a very formidable character indeed. Well, perhaps it was the thought that he was paying for the milk that kept Ziegfeld unsmiling. This is how Randolph Carter remembers the Ziegfeld-Anna Held partnership.
They were never married, but she did become his common-law wife. And she was really a brilliant entertainer of her day. And his first successes before the Follies were with Anna Held. And it was she who suggested the first Follies in 1907, though she wasn't in them.
The song that Anna knocked the mark with on Broadway was called Come and Play With Me. And it must have impressed Ziegfeld very much, because that's exactly what he seems to have spent the best years of his life doing, playing with Anna Held, though, of course, she was only the first of several.
I have not been here very long, as yet I'm quite a stranger, and so to try an English song may seem perhaps a danger. One plea I make, a favor slight, I hope you'll not refuse me, that if I don't pronounce it right, you kindly will excuse me. I'm fond of games and fun, you see. I wish you'd come and play with me. Oh, I have such a way with me, a way with me, a way with me. I have such a nice little way with me. Do not think it wrong. I should like you to play with me, to play with me, to play with me. I wish you'd come and play with me. Play with me all the day long. Oh, I have such a way with me, a way with me, a way with me. I have such a nice little way with me. Do not think it wrong. I should like you to play with me, to play with me, to play with me. I wish you'd come and play with me. Play with me all the day long, la la.
While Anna Held was singing that song nightly to New York audiences and carrying on a clandestine love affair with Ziegfeld that was about as clandestine as a May Day parade, Flo himself was busy thinking up publicity stunts like the milk ploy to keep Anna in the public eye. Profits were tumbling in thanks to Anna, whose background reads like a parody of the leading lady of the period. Although the facts are hopelessly mixed up, it might not be a bad idea to get her and Flo in some kind of focus as the 20th century dawns, if only to understand the forces which were conspiring to make Flo Ziegfeld the biggest name in American theater circles. Anna was said by the French to be Polish. And said by the Polish to be French. In fact, she was half Polish, half French. By the time Flo caught up with her, Anna Held already had quite a reputation in Europe. We know, for instance, that Toulouse-Lautrec sketched her. But then, as he appears to have sketched every female in Paris under 50 who was willing to take her clothes off, perhaps that doesn't mean too much. Flo bumped up against her, literally, in London, by which time he had already launched himself as a producer. 1889, Flo Ziegfeld produces The Dancing Ducks of Denmark. It later turned out that the ducks didn't come from Denmark and couldn't dance. Later, Ziegfeld produces The Invisible Brazilian Fish, an inexpensive production requiring nothing but a bowl of water. As one critic said, I just don't see it. 1892, Ziegfeld goes to Europe on Papa's behalf to sign up classical virtuosi. His idea of classical virtuosi turns out to be the Muhlmann Swiss mountaineer trio of Interlaken plus assorted jugglers, magicians, and acrobats. In 1893, Ziegfeld produces the great strongman Sandow at the Trocadero in Chicago. Success follows. Sandow is a considerable virtuoso whose artistic feats included holding a man in the palm of his hand, an art Ziegfeld must have copied from him, figuratively speaking. Bending pokers, balancing weights of 300 pounds, and one trick which must have made Flo especially envious, opening a safe with his teeth. In order to boost the box office takings, Flo charged $300 a time for ladies to feel Sandow's biceps. Creaky biceps. Now, what exactly was meant by biceps is one of those mysteries best buried in history. Later in the partnership, Ziegfeld sponsored Sandow against a lion, a fight which Sandow won, although it was rumoured that the lion, being a non-union member, was a blackleg. Sorry, mate. Now, while Sandow was throwing horses... thank you. And pianos... about... Ziegfeld began to speculate on stage comedy of the deliberate instead of the unintentional kind, and came up with a revival of an old success called a parlor match. Now, what was needed for a parlor match was a leading lady, which was where Anna Held came in. But one other thing that a parlor match had going for it was a song that Ziegfeld had picked up which cashed in on the new bicycling craze. That was the song that Anna and Flo used to sing together when they cycled around New York in leisure moments. In 1896, they were conducting an intensely passionate affair. Flo was crazy about Anna, but this didn't stop him from putting business before pleasure. At one stage, he wagered his new horse against a German singer who claimed to be able to deliver 1,000 consecutive kisses. The singer and Anna reached 114 before both contestants collapsed and Ziegfeld's horse stayed in its stable. In 1900, Anna was sculpted in solid gold. 1905, Anna buys a Welsh castle she never sets foot in. 1906, Flo loses 2.5 million francs gambling in Biarritz. Returned to New York with Anna, a big hit in the Parisian model. But it was the next year that Flo Ziegfeld finally arrived at the first edition of his famous Follies. In 1908, for the follow-up, he put on a new edition of the Follies, and in it there was contained one of the biggest song hits of all time.
February, June, or July. So time ain't no time to stay. Outdoors and spoons. So shine on, harvest moon.
For me and my gal. Shine on, harvest moon. Keep on a shining till I find the silvery lining in the sky. Since
100 years or so ago on the 4th of July. Slow time, ain't no time to stay. Outdoors and spoon, so shine on harvest moon.
For me and my gal.
For me and my gal.
The girl who sang that song for Ziegfeld was a lady called Nora Bays, and she turned out in the following year of 1909 to have quite a bit of flair and temperament herself. When Ziegfeld wanted to sign up another singer in the show with Nora, Miss Bays put her foot down, right on Sophie Tucker's neck.
It was at the actual opening of the Follies of 1909 when I first met Mr. Ziegfeld. But he wasn't a man that was interested in a big fat girl. He was interested in beautiful models, beautiful chorus girls, beautiful stars and things. I was just nothing. But I made him feel who I was right after the opening night. I went out to do a little scene. They were setting a scene behind me, and they gave me 4 or 5 minutes, and it lasted 12 minutes, and they were furious, but I won. They'd never heard singing of that type. Remember, in those days, I was a singer of jazz, just what you're doing today, only it was 40, 50 years ago. The star, Nora Bays, great star, just didn't want to have me in the show, and she was right. I was too big a success for her. She must be the headliner. I didn't understand it. Later on, I did, and I understand it full well today. But she was right. When you're a star of a show, you must have nobody interfere with your success.
Meanwhile, what of Anna Held? Well, she was gradually getting older, as a great many people often do, and in any case, Flo was not the type to let the ivy grow up his leg. By 1908, he was having a florid affair with a showgirl called Lillian Lorraine. Lillian sounds from the descriptions to have been marginally more dangerous than that lion that Sandow had wrestled. Randolph Carter's view is substantiated by most people.
Lillian Lorraine was very, very beautiful, and she was a terrible bitch. There's no question about it. And she gave Ziegfeld a very hard time. Also, she had a very bad drinking problem. She had a very sad end, practically ended up derelictical. He was absolutely fascinated by her, and he billed her as the most beautiful woman in the world, and the pictures that exist would rather confirm that. I don't think she had much talent, but she was extremely beautiful.
Well, Lillian, too, went the way of all flesh in due course, leaving Flo to continue his campaign for which he became famous. As he used to define it in the publicity copy for his shows, it was a case of glorifying the American girl. But to his credit, he also glorified the American boy from time to time. In 1910, the Ziegfeld Follies starred one of the great comic drolls of American show history, the American Negro performer Bert Williams. Williams used to lope across the stage with a slow, lazy rhythm and sing songs that had a kind of doleful laughter about them. His most famous number was called Nobody.
When life seems full of clouds and rain, and I am full of nothing and pain, who soothes my bumping brain? Nobody. When winter comes with snow and sleet, and me with hunger and cold feet, who tells you 25 cents? Go ahead and get something to eat. Nobody. dreaming of him from nobody, no time. Until I get something from somebody sometime. I never did know for nobody, no time.
Brilliant as Bert Williams was, he wasn't the only sensation of the 1910 Follies, because Ziegfeld found another obscure performer whose appearance in the Follies that year was only the start of a very long and very illustrious career. Now, she wasn't quite the sort of girl that Flo Ziegfeld, or indeed anyone else, could glorify, because she wasn't remotely beautiful. As a matter of fact, she looked like an average sort of person, an average woman. But it was what she sounded like that mattered.
Here I am, there you'll be, miles and miles away from me. I can't see the good and goodbye. Still, best of friends have to part. Don't lose sleep and don't lose heart. You know me, so baby, don't cry. I'd rather be blue thinking of you. I'd rather be blue over you than be happy with somebody else. I can't do without you, out you. For you I'm strong, I'm crazy about you. Out you, but out you, don't stay too long. I need a little little ooh, little oh, and I'm knocking on wood. To be good, I'd rather be blue thinking of you. I'd rather be blue over you than be happy with somebody else. We like the good, we like the bad. Don't be a fool, you fool. My little flat, I'm turning that into a Sunday school. While you're away, I'm here to say there'll be no Iceman there. Singing the blues, I'm gonna use nothing but frigid air. Still, I'd rather be blue thinking of you. I'd rather be blue over you than be happy.
Fanny Brice, the original funny girl whose speciality when Ziegfeld found her playing burlesque was Jewish immigrant lower life. Towards the end of her career, Fanny described the sort of thing she was getting up to when the Ziegfeld Follies came along and wrote, "My song summed up Losher of the Coney Island popcorn counter and Martyr of the cheeses at Brodsky's Delicatessen and the Sadies and the Rachels with the turnover heels at the Second Avenue dance halls." In other words, Fanny was doing what all the great artists do, reflecting her time in her work. The story of her joust with Ziegfeld over the salary for the Follies became a showbiz legend a long time ago, which probably means that it isn't true, but it makes a nice story. Ziegfeld asked her what she wanted, and Fanny answered, $40. When Ziegfeld seemed surprised, she was just about to lower the figure when the showman said, "Let's say 75 and a year's guarantee."
I'm a wedding, second and head, second and hollow, so that's why they call me second and roll. Even a piano in the parlor, father bought for 10 cents and the even Jakey Cohen, he's the man I adore, had the nerve to tell me he's been married before. Everyone knows that I'm just second hand row from Second Avenue.
So the Ziegfeld Follies of 1910 can fairly be described as a turning point in the history of American entertainment because, besides establishing the convention of the annual Follies, it also introduced two great stars, Burt Williams and Fanny Brice. And it also revealed Ziegfeld's generous nature when it came to girlfriends. Now, who should be in the show? Anna Held or Lillian Lorraine? Ziegfeld, probably figuring that whichever one got left out would put snakes in his bed, solved the problem by putting both of them in, although by now Anna had more or less admitted defeat. The 1910 Follies made history and established once and for all Ziegfeld's reputation as a creative showman, but how original was he really? That erudite historian of American popular theater, Stanley Green, has one or two reservations.
Well, of course, Ziegfeld was the man who was generally credited with starting the revue form on the Broadway musical stage. He actually wasn't. There was a man named Lederer from the end of the 19th century put out the first of what were called follies. They were adapted from the French revue form. Ziegfeld later on used the form himself. Through the years, he established a very high level of artistry and of comedy, songs, personality. But practically everything that he did in these productions was subservient to what he called glorifying the American girl. And they would parade up and down, and they could depict the animals on a farm, or I'm sure that if he were around today, he'd certainly do something on the United Nations or whatever. They usually didn't have many things on their bodies, the girls, but they had headdresses, which were very elaborate, which would represent whatever it could have been. They were all very, very tall and very attractive, and he was very, very exacting in the kind of costumes that the girls would wear. And the material always had to be the finest.
What Stanley Green says about the costumes is borne out by the extraordinary photographs which have survived of the Ziegfeld shows. In these fading sepia glimpses of a vanished age, giantesque young ladies stand there wearing apparently every article of clothing they possess in the world. But what makes it all very different is that they're wearing it on top of their heads. Everything from bird cages to imitation soup tureens, from lampshades to multi-fingered candelabras. It's said that the girls in the Ziegfeld line walked exquisitely. But looking at what they had to drag around with them, it's a wonder they were able to walk at all. Ziegfeld rustled up the capital to pay for it all somehow, but in 1910, he had other problems. Lillian Lorraine, to mention just a few. It was said by some Broadway wiseacre that nobody knew who Lillian would be sleeping with next, and neither did Lillian. For the 1911 Follies, Ziegfeld paired her off with an Australian underfed gargoyle who was later to become a star in Hollywood, and his name was Leon Errol. In mid-run, Lillian went off and married a rich man's son who had also been intriguing with Fanny Brice. One night, Lillian and Fanny had a spectacular wrestling match which ended with Fanny dragging Lillian on stage by her hair. No wonder the Follies drew capacity houses, for they were Ziegfeld's own personal Follies in a very special sense. All this time, Anna Held was standing about in the wings, as it were, helping Flo with his professional as well as with his private life. And in the winter of 1911-1912, the two of them went to catch an act they had been told was something special. This was what they heard.
When I'm good, I'm very good. But when I'm bad, I'm better.
Boy, is that hot!
I'm free and easy. My life's my own. I come and go as I choose. Just look me over. Say I'm plenty known. I take what I want or refuse. I've got the face of a saint. On the level it ain't paint. So beware of these eyes. I'm a devil in disguise. And they call me Sister Hanky Tank. I sing a passionate strain. Then I'm low down again. It's fire and it's flame, so be careful of this day. And they call me Sister Hanky Tank. They call me Sister Hanky Tank. Mm-hmm. Oh. Tommy Boy. No wisecracks now.
Wrap it up and take it home with you, boys.
Do I make myself clear, boys? Boys, you know you're only human. Give yourself a break, come on this way. I'm not looking for a true man. All you need's the price, come on and pay. I walk and talk like a queen. Man, that's just what I mean. But if you'll buy, I'll sell. It's a loving trip too. And they call me Sister Hanky Tank. I better go now. They call me Sister Hanky Tank. Oh, come up and see me sometime. And they call
Well, it's not the many of life that counts, it's the life in your men.
Mae West, one of the few artists who turned down Ziegfeld's offer, saying that his shows weren't intimate enough, whatever that was supposed to mean. However, in 1912, she relented and worked for Flo after all. Now, in that year, Anna finally got a divorce, which was very difficult as she'd never actually married Flo in the first place. But the law is a marvellous thing, and the two ex-lovers were officially sundered. Meanwhile, Lillian Lorraine continued to live the gay life. In 1911, one man shot another man dead for her, and in 1912, her rich husband suddenly broke into Ziegfeld's dining room and, to quote one biography, began to beat him to death. Only the intervention of the police saved Ziegfeld's life, and so made it safe for MGM to bowdlerize in a famous movie more than 20 years later. Today, very little of the scandal and the salaciousness, the angry fights and the shout-ups are remembered. What has survived are the reputations of the stars whom Ziegfeld encouraged and the songs that audiences first heard at the Follies. In 1909, to follow up the success in the previous year of Nora Bay's with Shine on Harvest Moon, Ziegfeld put his money on the moon once more and produced a song which became one of the favorites of the future President Wilson. In spite of President Wilson's approval, it was still a good song.
By the light,
by the light, by the light
of the silvery moon,
the light of the silvery, silvery moon,
I want to spoon,
want to spoon, want to spoon
to my honey, honey of croon, love's tune. Honeymoon,
honeymoon,
keep a shining in June,
a shining, a shining, a shining in June.
Your silvery themes
will
bring love's dreams,
will
be coddling
soon.
In 1912, the year that the affairs with Anna Held and Lillian Lorraine were reeling towards their disastrous climaxes, the Follies included another beloved American song. And to this day, when an artist wants to evoke the so-called good old days, the days when a writer called O. Henry was doing for New York from the same job that Damon Runyon was to perform a generation later, that is, giving New Yorkers a romantic view of themselves, in the days of amateur ukulele players pulling strings all over the Union, this was the song which summed it all up.
Oh,
Ziegfeld was terrific. At least he was in his day. I don't know that he would be now. He had the cult of beauty. He had girls working for him who were beautiful. All they had to do was walk across the stage. He paid $300 a week, which in those days was a lot of money. Ziegfeld was a very extravagant guy. He was not very good on humor, but he certainly was good on beauty.
The grand old man of American theater criticism, Brooks Atkinson. And one of the points he made about Flo Ziegfeld is central to the personality of the man, his financial extravagance. Now, Ziegfeld always had the reputation, which has lingered right on until today, of sparing no expense when it came to life in the theater. But the question arises, whose expense? Composer Arthur Schwartz drops a hint.
Well, he was an extravagant man, a wonderful producer of shows who didn't know how to restrain himself. He didn't make any money. He died broke. I remember there was one show that played to capacity for a year and didn't earn back one penny because it was overproduced. The salaries were so great, the royalties and everything else. That was true of several shows. He did get backing constantly because he had friends who were very rich. I guess they didn't mind losing money. It may be that one or two of his shows made money, but most of them didn't.
Well, even though the Ziegfeld shows almost never made anyone's fortunes, an awful quantity of greenbacks did pass through Ziegfeld's hands. Millions and millions of them. What happened to them? Well, Brooks Atkinson provides one or two details.
He never went anywhere except in a private car on a railroad. He would send telegrams to people on the floor beneath him. He was on the top floor of this office building, and he would send telegrams to people below. He sent me a telegram once about some show I reviewed, and I was very stupid. I thought they were real elephants that he was showing on the stage, and I praised the real elephants, but it turned out they were papier-mâché elephants. And he sent me a telegram, and also the publisher of the Times, saying, "You can't employ a fool like this who doesn't know the difference between a phony elephant and a real elephant."
There's an old superstition way down south. Everybody believes that trouble won't stay if you shake it off. When they hold a revival way down south, everybody with care and trouble that day tries to shake it away. Blues away,
away,
unhappy news away,
away.
If you were blue, it's easy to shake off your cares and troubles, telling the blues to go,
to go.
They may refuse to go,
to go,
but as a rule they'll go if you shake them away,
shake them away.
Do like the voodoos do, listen to voodoo melody, they shake their bodies to and fro with every shake, a lucky break, proving that there's a way,
a way,
to chase your cares away,
a way.
If you would lose your weary blues, shake them away.
That was one of the two big Berlin hits that took place in Ziegfeld productions around the time that the First World War was ending. It also marked a new background of domestic bliss, or at least partial bliss. In 1914, he had married the famous flutter-brained comedian of later Hollywood movies, Billy Burke. And there were some startling changes in Flo's behavior pattern. Visitors to the big new house in Berkeley Crest on the Hudson River saw the great impresario gardening, terrorizing the gardeners, and studying the art of encouraging chickens to produce eggs. There was a distinctly English flavor to the house, an impression that was accented by Billy Burke's appetite for giving literary dinner parties at which guests included the English playwright Somerset Maugham and Arthur Pinero. Now, Flo hated all this. It just wasn't his scene. And more to his taste was his new departure in 1915, the Frolics, which were the Follies, only starting at midnight. The odd thing was that for all the lurid goings-on in his own love life, Ziegfeld insisted not only on glorifying the American girl, but apparently purifying her too. No drinking was allowed in the dressing rooms, and no men were allowed to visit there. The Frolics today are remembered for having introduced yet another great star of the American theater.
Now, folks, all I know is just what little news I read every day in the papers. I see where another wife out on Long Island near New York just shot her husband. Season opened a month earlier this year. Prohibition caused all this. There's just as many husbands shot at in the old days, but women were missing them. Prohibition's improved the marksmanship 90%. Never a day passes in New York without some innocent bystander being shot. You just stand around this town long enough and be innocent, and somebody's going to shoot you. One day, there was four shots. That's the best shooting ever done in this town. It's hard to find four innocent people in New York, even if you don't stop to shoot them. That's why a policeman never has to aim here. He just shoots up the street anywhere. No matter who he hits, it's the right one.
The homespun philosopher cowboy Will Rogers, who would stand around the stage dispensing pearls of wisdom while twirling a lariat or whittling a piece of wood. Ziegfeld, whose sense of humor appears to have been non-existent, detested everything Rogers did, but he made him an international celebrity for all that. The customers laughed, and that was enough for Ziegfeld. In the meantime, Billy, his wife, was already being noticed by the emergent motion picture industry, and by 1915, she was out on the West Coast working in front of the cameras, leaving Flo free to work behind the scenes in connection with yet another chorus girl, this time called Olive Thomas. By 1916, the Follies had taken on a Shakespearean look with Bert Williams as the most improbable Othello in history. And in a scene depicting aspects of American history, there appeared on stage for Ziegfeld one of the most extraordinary characters on or off the stage that the modern era has produced. His voice, like the rest of him, including his nose, remains unmistakable to this day.
Throughout the Middle Ages, the use of liquor was universal, and drunkenness was so common, it was unnoticed. They called it the Middle Ages because no one was able to walk home unless they were between two other fellows. I was the middle guy.
W.C. Fields, the original proof of the old proposition that the best way to cure a red nose is to drink until it turns purple. Ziegfeld not only didn't laugh at W.C. Fields' humor, but detested him as a person. But, once again, he found himself on the horns of a comedian's dilemma. He had to put up with Fields, just as he had to endure Will Rogers and all the other comics who worked for him, because they made everyone else laugh, even if Flo himself sat there with a glum face. In 1918, the Follies reflected the patriotic fever of the climax of the Great War, and it was now that Irving Berlin came up with one of his best-known songs.
Oh, how I hate to get up in the morning. Oh, how I'd love to remain in bed. For the hardest blow of all is to hear the bugler call. You gotta get up, you gotta get up, you gotta get up this morning. Someday I'm going to murder the bugler. Someday they're going to find him dead. I'll amputate his reveille and step upon it heavily and spend the rest of my life in bed.
Oh, how I hate to get up in the morning. Oh, how
as for Flo Ziegfeld himself, he was continuing his policy of getting up in the morning and finding himself next to as many different young ladies as possible. And not that he ever allowed business to mix with pleasure, as Keenan Wynn explains.
There's a story I was not present at, but my dad used to tell. Mr. Ziegfeld was having an affair with a girl on the show. It doesn't matter about her name. It does, but it doesn't for the story. Mr. Ziegfeld would have what is called a dress parade. He'd see all the costumes and check everything, you know, and this showgirl, big regal showgirl. Mr. Ziegfeld is all alone in the middle of the theater with a hat, always wore the hat and the charvet ties, you know, and a cigar. And he's sitting there and he's looking, he's watching, with the denim suits, you know, the double-breasted vests. And she walked down and she said, "Ziggy, I can't wear this dress, it's impossible. This is a ridiculous costume, Ziggy." And he said, "Mr. Ziegfeld in the theater, dear, Ziggy in bed."
By 1919, the Great War might have been over, but the one between Broadway showmen and the Actors Union was only just beginning. While the 1919 Follies were opening, Equity called a strike. Ziegfeld put an injunction on every member of his own cast and sued Equity. On August the 13th, five members of the Follies cast failed to turn up for the performance, and Ziegfeld had to give the audience its money back. One of the five defaulting artists was a singer called John Steele, who isn't very important in the context of Ziegfeld's career, except that it was he who sang the outstanding ballad of 1919, the one Irving Berlin had written for the Follies, and the one whose sentiments are so perfect an expression of everything a Ziegfeld show stood for. The glorification of the American girl, the sentimentalizing of romance, the propagation of the myth that there is something pure and sweet and unsullied about a showgirl walking about with a facsimile of Grant's tomb or the Brooklyn Bridge on her head. Ever since the Follies introduced the song, people have been singing it and associating it with the image of feminine charm. Now, next week, we'll be looking into the stormy but not altogether unsuccessful Ziegfeld family life and his theatrical progress as his shows became ever more lavish, ever more expensive. But for the moment, let's leave the great Ziegfeld with Irving Berlin's symbolic sentiments, which can be summed up in the dubious proposition that a pretty girl is like a melody.
That was the first program in the series The American Showman, and the first of three programs on Flo Ziegfeld. Michael Craig was the presenter, Bill Sullivan the researcher, Benny Green the writer, and David Raven Allen the producer. There'll be further oral delights for your enjoyment in the coming weeks throughout this series. Meanwhile, for the next few minutes, Benny Green adds a postscript to this evening's program and takes a peek at next Tuesday's. Benny Green.
A very remarkable man, Flo Ziegfeld. An egocentric, not a man you could trust with any woman except perhaps his own wife. Unreliable with money, erratic in judgment, a hopeless spendthrift, and absolutely lacking in anything remotely to do with a sense of humour. And yet, a master showman, one of the greatest impresarios in the history of popular entertainment. Next week we'll hear how he employed, and in one or two cases virtually discovered, at least so far as Broadway was concerned, some of the greatest comics of the century. As he grew older, Ziegfeld did not do what you might imagine he did, grow up and out of his juvenile preoccupation with ladies wearing nothing much more than hats and dignity. He made an attempt, though. Next week's programme tells how he became a husband and a father, and how he bravely managed to carry on as though nothing had happened. When Flo Ziegfeld defined his destiny as glorifying the American girl, he meant in private as well as on the stage, and there were times when the two all got mixed up. When a grown man spends millions getting shapely, undrapely young ladies to mince around the stage, can it not be that he is fulfilling some fantasy of his own? And if, in fulfilling it, Flo Ziegfeld gave himself a lot of pleasure as well as the audiences who throng to the shows, can we blame him? Can we say that we would have behaved any differently? Yes, of course we can. But then we're not Flo Ziegfeld, who seems to have been involved in half the legends of the period. That's one of the great pleasures of delving into his life, that things we took for granted turn out to be something quite different. Remember, for instance, that well-thumbed legend of the Ziegfeld first night when Al Jolson, seeing his wife Ruby Keeler, the star of the show, in difficulties at the top of a high staircase, stood up in the stalls and sang Liza and saved the day. Well, now let's pull the other one. It wasn't quite like that.
I know that they did do it in the movie. I haven't seen the movie, but the way I understand it, they said that I was fainted or I was getting dizzy, but that wasn't true at all. I didn't think it was a very nice thing to do because it was not his show and he was not in the show. There were other people in the show that, you know, that were doing pretty well. I don't think Mr. Ziegfeld was probably delighted because it got great press, It was such an unusual thing to happen.
How much of all this is to do with Flo Ziegfeld? We don't know, except that years later, somebody wrote his biography and described how that much-publicised moment was actually included in the show's rehearsals. Well, if that's true, it wouldn't surprise us. Ziegfeld was the master showman, and sometimes a narrowly diverted fiasco makes the greatest show of all. In next week's programme, we'll follow Ziegfeld as he climbs to the zenith of his power and influence and success. We'll see him stage everything from revue to really rather adult musicals, and how everything he touched made money. We'll also see how the greatest show of all, the United States of America, suddenly closed in October 1929 when Wall Street crashed and ended the good times. We'll follow the second of the three acts that are reminiscent of a Greek tragedy, the climb, the great summit, and then the laughter of the gods as the whole thing falls to pieces. Before Flo Ziegfeld fell to pieces, he had a wonderful time. Next week, that time will be described by people who knew him. People like the composer Arthur Schwartz, the comic actor Keenan Wynn, the dancer Claire Luce, who fell in love with the piano player, the lyricist Johnny Mercer, the show business historian Stanley Green, and also artists like Eddie Cantor, Al Jolson, Fanny Bryce, Helen Morgan, Doris Day, and also Margaret Whiting, who one day, a long time after the captains and the kings had departed and only the broker's men remained, recorded a very beautiful song that Flo Ziegfeld, this man who knew nothing about music, bought for the stage and helped to make famous. Next week, we'll hear how.
But along came Bill, who's not the type at all. You'd meet him on the street and never notice him. His form and face, his manly grace, are not the kind that you would find in a statue. And I can't explain, it's surely not his brain that makes me thrill. I love him because he is wonderful, because he's just